I like being female, and I have never felt even remotely bad about being female. I don't know if that's because I've always steadfastly avoided women's magazines, which I think are just designed to make you feel bad.
Journalist Molly Ziegler-Hemingway speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
But I've always known that being female is pretty awesome. And the only time it actually occurs to me to even feel remotely bad about it is when feminists start telling me that I'm doing everything wrong. And I think it's so interesting that feminists have such a problem with these traits that we do associate with women a little bit more. Feminists are on this campaign to make women more like men.
You can listen to Molly's presentation, Making the Case for the Differences Between Men and Women, and teachings by Paul Meyer, David Menton, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Jonathan Fisk on an audio DVD from the 2015 Making the Case conference. We'll send it to you for a donation of $300 before Labor Day. Just click the DVD logo at issuesetc.org. We are very myopic, it's true. American culture tends to be a bit of an echo chamber, and while we don't want to underestimate what has been changing over the last 25 years, and especially in the last 2 months, on the issue of natural marriage, the wholesale redefinition, legal redefinition of marriage by the Supreme Court recently, we don't want to underestimate that. We do have to step back and get the bigger picture here. Does this mean that marriage is ruined worldwide? We are just one country, or just one relatively young country, influential, economically powerful, militarily powerful, yes, all of those things, but the United States isn't the world. And perhaps it helps us to get a little perspective if we step back and see how natural marriage is faring on the planet rather than just our little corner, our little insulated and somewhat isolated corner of the world. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Wednesday afternoon. It's the 5th of August. We're going to be talking with Dr. Alan Carlson. He's written an article for Touchstone Magazine, Majority Report, The Future of Marriage and Natural Family. We'll get some perspective there as well. You can join us anytime in the next hour, 1-877-623-6943. 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc. Our beloved on-demand listeners use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. And a little bit later, Pastor Hal Sinkby will join us. We're going to talk about the means of grace, the word, and the sacraments, how Christ comes to us in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Joining us to talk about the international state of natural marriage and the family, Dr. Alan Carlson. He's a regular guest, president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, author of 10 books, including The Natural Family, A Manifesto, and he's also written an editorial in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Majority Report, The Future of Marriage and the Natural Family. Dr. Carlson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
I'm always pleased to be with you.
I'm interested how you describe this. You say same-sex marriage is merely the current enthusiasm of a relatively small number of deracinated, secularized, mostly childless, and largely white elites. What are you saying there?
What I'm saying is that if you look at the whole globe, the nations of the globe, this is a very much a minority phenomenon, and I think it's going to remain that way. There are 200 nations who are members of the United Nations. Of those, only 20 have adopted same-sex marriage. And all of them, with maybe one exception, South Africa, all the rest are in Western or Central Europe or in North America. And that's it. These are Western countries, so-called Western countries, formerly Western Christian countries, which have dropped Christianity and have dropped any deference to the normative human social condition, which is, among others, than Christians as well. Among 180 nations, hold to a very conventional, traditional understanding of marriage as between one man and one woman. And, again, that's not going to change. This includes nations, almost all the nations of Africa, of Latin America, of Asia. It includes most of the nations of Eastern Europe, again, with one or two exceptions. It includes such surprise stalwart defenders of marriage as Russia and China. So let's get a grip on it. We're part of the minority here.
Okay. You say it's also very important to understand that the advances before and now the latest kind of leap forward for the homosexual marriage agenda in the Supreme Court's decision has been almost entirely the action of judicial activism. Why is that so important to keep in mind here, even within our narrow context?
Well, we have to put aside the polls which have been put before us, again, by a media that I think is fairly biased, and I really don't trust many of these polls. But in almost every case, the adoption of same-sex marriage by the states prior to the Supreme Court decision, with one or two, again, with three or four exceptions, were done by court decisions, either state court decision, which was then affirmed by the federal courts, or by federal courts overturning state laws. The democratic process was not followed. The will of the people embodied in the laws on the books were simply thrown out. Again, there were a couple of exceptions, but even in those cases, I think the results would have been different if there had not been this media-generated sense of momentum, quote-unquote, this same-sex marriage is sweeping America, let's get on board. And even in those cases, it was countries, states that are ominously close to Canada, who seem to be the ones who voted it in democratically, and I'm thinking specifically of Minnesota, and Vermont. So there again, we're dealing again with a minority phenomenon. The courts imposed this on the American people. We did not have the opportunity to work this out democratically. If we had, I think same-sex marriage would be confined to, at best, two or three states in the United States right now.
Okay. I guess the other thing that we need to discuss here to kind of lay a foundation for the international picture, the global picture of natural marriage and the family, is something that takes us all the way back to 1948, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What is this document, and what does it have to say to us today about this issue?
Well, it's an incredibly important document, and I know many conservatives distrust anything that has ever come out of the United Nations. That's not entirely fair. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a wonderful, positive document. It deals with universal rights, but it has a strong Christian accent because it was Christian Democrats who really shaped it, particularly on its measures dealing with family. The document came out after World War II, when you'd had the horrible events of fascism in Italy, of the rise of Nazism in Germany, the militarism in Japan, all of which were finally defeated after a horrible war with the loss of many tens of millions of lives. And people had to put the world back together. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was one way in which they tried to take the lessons learned from the disasters of the prior 30 years and reframe a moral vision for the future. They do that very well. Christian Democrats were behind it. Who are the Christian Democrats? Well, they were the ones who put Europe back together again after World War II. Their inspirations were both Catholic and Protestant. Catholic strand goes back to Pope Leo XIII in the late 19th century. The Protestant strand is best identified with Abraham Kuyper. He was a Dutch Reformed pastor, but also a politician in the Netherlands in the early 20th century. A new generation of Christian Democratic leaders emerged in the 1940s. They put Europe back together again, and they crafted Article 16 of the Universal Declaration.
What does it have to say there?
Well, it's very clear about several important things. First of all, that the family is a critically important component of any healthy and just society. Christian Democrats said you have to have institutions between individuals and the state. If you don't, the state will crush the individual. And that basically is what had happened under the fascists and the Nazis. So they argued that there were natural institutions, the most important of which was the family, and it had to be protected. So Article 16 is very clear. It says, quote, men and women of full age have the right to marry and found a family. Again, note who gets to marry here, men and women. And that quote, the family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and entitled to protection by society and the state. The word natural, I think, is key here. It explains that the natural family is what all governments that have any justice are required to protect and defend.
And I'm interested there in the kind of dual protection that it seems to acknowledge, either implicitly or explicitly. And that is, one, as you just said, the state, any decent state, has the obligation to defend this natural institution of marriage and the family, but also that that institution of marriage and the family is a protection to the individual from the state. Talk about that.
Well, it's a very key point. The individual can only thrive if he or she is tied in with other people and with other natural institutions, family, neighborhood, religious community, extended family. Without those, you are naked and alone, and the government, evil governments, will take charge of your life and make you do terrible things. That's what happens. So the key to this is, in fact, yes, that the individual standing alone is easy prey for dictators and monstrous political systems. The family is there to protect the individual, to allow the individual to thrive and grow. You know, and some of the great teachers of the Lutheran tradition, from Martin Luther to Walther and others to the present, have seen the very same thing. The family has a natural obligation. Has a natural performance that ensures, at least, gets us as close as we can in this world towards a good life.
Why is it so important? Because these words really matter. You say that there was some attempt, perhaps even a well-meaning attempt, to pare this thing down and not talk about the natural family or natural marriage. Why is that word natural so very important in our understanding of that document, but also in understanding of our current context?
Well, it has a sense of being attached to something like the natural law. That is, that we can see that God intended human sexuality to be heterosexual. Male and female were created that way. Martin Luther is so clear on this. He's got some wonderful passages in his commentary on Genesis, for example, and is on his writings on marriage say the very same thing. So we have it's recognizing this natural aspect. During the debate over the Declaration in 1948, there was an attempt by the delegate from Uruguay in Latin America to strip the word natural from the phrase. He said we want to defend family, but family can take many different forms, and we shouldn't be trying to restrict it. That was soundly defeated at the time. More recently, in the last several years, twice the Barack Obama administration has led efforts at the United Nations to try to, again, strip the word natural out of the Article 16C and to emphasize that families can come in many different forms and all different forms, and it really doesn't matter how they're structured. Historically, that's just simply not true. Sociologically, it's not true. It makes a huge difference, family structure does. And so it's critically important to keep that word in there because it does reflect the wisdom of the ages.
Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. We'll have another 10 minutes with him on the other side of the break. We're talking about the international state of natural marriage and the family. He's president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. He's written an editorial in the latest Touchstone magazine titled Majority Report, The Future of Marriage and the Natural Family. We'll be right back.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Why do the gospel accounts differ? Why did Jesus use parables? Are there demon-possessed people today? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August is the big book of New Testament questions and answers. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Big Book of New Testament Questions and Answers is written by Dr. Michael Eschelbach of Concordia University, Chicago. The Big Book of New Testament Questions and Answers.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century. The 6th century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the international state of marriage and the natural family. Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. He is author of 10 books, including The Natural Family, A Manifesto. He's president of the Howard Center for Family and Religion Society based in Rockford, Illinois. You can find out more about the Howard Center at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. In about 15 minutes, we're going to discuss the means of grace with Pastor Hal Sinkbile. I'm curious, you mentioned before the break that there have been ongoing efforts, including late efforts of the Barack Obama administration, to get rid of that term natural. What do they find objectionable about that term? And is that, in fact, a de facto admission, Dr. Carlson, that what they are advocating for is, at least from our perspective, unnatural?
That's what the battle is about. This is, in some ways, the culture wars over the last 50 or 60 years involving abortion, birth control, the meaning of marriage, the protection of family, all have their roots in trying to come to grips with the understanding of the word natural. And it gets to a fundamental issue of what is the moral order? What is morality? One tradition, the natural law tradition, says that there is a created order that was fixed by God, whatever is in accordance with that natural order is good. Whatever violates that natural order is bad. And certainly that includes human sexuality. The honest advocates of same-sex marriage will admit that there is in human physiognomy and human biology, there is something natural to heterosexual relationships that is not true of homosexual ones. The other view of morality, the modern view, is that is moral, which relates to the way people, a majority of people, behave. If they behave a certain way or if they accept a certain belief, that's the moral belief, and anyone who opposes the view of the majority, or the so-called majority, is the person who becomes immoral. Two fundamentally different views of the way of what morality is. That's the battle that's taking place, and the word natural is central and core to it. You're right. The other side, the advocates of the LGBT agenda of same-sex marriage, do not like the word natural at all.
You had written before the Supreme Court's decision in Obergefell, if the Supreme Court embraces same-sex marriage as a constitutional right, which it, of course it did, it will in the long run mean little. Do you stand by that, Dr. Carlson?
I still think that's true. That's the funny thing right now. The United States has joined with some nations of Europe, or at least the nations of most of Western and Central Europe, in trying to deny the natural order of the universe, the natural order to human sexuality. We've enlisted, our country has been enlisted by force, by judicial force, into the sexual revolution. But I have a feeling most of the world's not going to go along. We are the outliers at this point. It's really interesting that the nations that were who were evangelized, oh, say, 150, 200 years ago, up until recently, the nations of Africa, the nations of Asia, these are the lands which at one time practiced openly tolerated or openly encouraged homosexuality, polygamy, and so on. Christian missionaries came there, taught them differently, showed them the right way. They adopted it eventually, and now those countries still get it. They still understand Christian ethics. I don't think they're going to change. The nations, at least right now, it's the nations of the West who are the outliers, who have bought into a corrupt and ultimately quite self-defeating and destructive sexual order. But the rest of the world, I don't think, is going to join us.
Is this? I want you to talk a little bit about the pressures that the United States and other, we would say, developed countries have gone this direction, Western Europe, apply to other nations there. And I wonder if you would go so far as to characterize it as a kind of imperialism.
Much so. It's very much a kind of cultural imperialism. It's focused mainly on vulnerable countries, and by that I mean nations in Africa and Asia that are fairly poor, that rely on sometimes, in some cases, of foreign aid and foreign assistance of various kinds. We saw a perfect example just a week or two ago when Barack Obama visited Kenya and put pressure on the Kenyans to adopt same-sex marriage and other parts of the LGBT agenda. To his credit, the president of Kenya, Mr. Kenyatta, threw it back at Mr. Obama and said, these are non-issues for us. We are a religious people, a Christian and a Muslim people, and we just aren't going to do this. The irony in this, and indeed the corruption in this, is that there are actual nations out there which, for example, still impose the death penalty for homosexuality, particularly among the Muslim countries, particularly the most prominent example being Saudi Arabia. I think that's an outrageous and terrible thing to do, certainly an unchristian thing to do. But with that said, when Barack Obama goes to Saudi Arabia, he doesn't say a peep about that. He wouldn't dare. They're rich. It's a rich country with lots of oil. We don't want to make him mad. But when he goes to Africa, he'll lean on the Africans. He'll push the Africans. He'll bribe. He'll threaten. And so will others in the West. Why? Because they're vulnerable. That's not the, shall we say, it's not the behavior of, I think, a person with a consistent morality. It's more of the behavior of a bully.
There seems to be at least implicit in that kind of action, and this could also arise as objection from somebody listening to us saying, look, the United States, we're developed, and these other countries, come on, they're backward. Many of them are living in not just the last century, but the century before that or even farther back. We're simply trying, as more enlightened civilization, to bring them up to speed. How would you respond?
I'm an historian by training, and what are the lessons of history? And indeed, it's a lesson of Scripture, particularly the Old Testament, is that wealth and quote-unquote development and riches are no guarantee of moral order. In fact, it's almost always the opposite. Rich, wealthy countries, which become focused on things and materialism and wealth, grow corrupt. As they say, original sin is one of the few Christian doctrines that's been proved by history time and time again. So I just think they're looking at the wrong way. Actually, simple people living more simply, probably at least have the opportunity. Maybe it's easier for them to be better Christians. Wealth corrupts. Simplicity, focus on the on the fundamentals of human life actually, I think, makes it possible to be a better person.
And in a society where your very existence depends upon institutions like family, like natural marriage, and you don't have the resources to buy your way out of the consequences of running afoul of those, these people view these issues as an issue of survival for themselves, don't they?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And in fact, like I say, many of the African nations see Christianity as having led them out of the darkness that they had fallen into, and for various reasons in their own history, but it had led them toward a much more enlightened view of human sexuality, a much more elevating view. Christians should not apologize for the Christian moral and sexual ethic. It actually is what's best for all concerned, for men, for women, for children. Again, that's not a statement even that I just say out of faith. I say it out of fundamental social science. That's what's been proven time and time again across the board. We shouldn't have to apologize for it, but that's what we wind up doing and cringing in the face of the new sexual ethic.
Early in your editorial, you actually make a connection between countries that have adopted a homosexual marriage and all that goes along with the sexual revolution. You make a connection between that and the culture of death. What is that connection?
Well, the connection is the acceptance of the sexual revolution, which again broke out of the back alleys in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s, which is being institutionalized now in law. And it ultimately is a culture of death. It sneers at procreative marriage. It tends to see children either as an unnecessary, you know, sort of an accident, or in fact a distraction from the real pursuit of pleasure and sensual delights. Nations that buy into it, they die. They cease to support young married couples, procreative couples. They wind up supporting everything else and encouraging everything else. They wind up confusing the young. Their fertility falls off. Eventually, they become a culture that kind of celebrates sterility and death, and there's no future for such a society.
I have heard this described, the push toward homosexual marriage in particular at the legal level, as a war on reality. Would you agree with that assessment?
It's a war on nature. In that sense, yes, I would. And again, this is not just faith speaking. This is one of those cases, particularly relative to family life and sexual life, is where the lessons of Christian faith, the truths of Christianity, coincide completely with the findings of modern social science. Adults do best when they're in a heterosexual married relationship. They're faithful to each other for their lives. Children do best when they grow up in a home of such people. Any deviation from that, be it divorce, single parenting, same-sex marriage, any deviation results in predictably more trouble. Not always, but predictably. That's the lesson of the ages, and it's one that the so-called Western nations today are trying to forget and ignore. It won't work. A terrible price will be paid.
Finally, you say that we really ought to remember the Christians in Western civilization, really ought to remember that the church has always been a transnational, transnational being, not an organization, but an organism. Why is that so important for Christians with the myopia of kind of the American sight to know now?
Yeah. Well, it is true. We are an international movement. We always have been. We've had to pay. We should pay. We do pay, as I say, deference to the various Caesars that history has raised or thrown up. We do that. We give Caesar his coin, as Jesus taught us. But with that said, we're always Christian truth transcends all such rulers. Christian truth transcends the United States of America, even at its best. and we're not at our best right now. Where hope lies is in that international movement. Even in Europe, the place where I talked about the culture of death, interesting, fascinating things are happening. In the last couple of years, there are young Christian leaders have emerged who have put 1 million people, or over 1 million people each, in the streets of Madrid, in the streets of Paris, in the streets of Rome most recently, to protect, both to advocate for the defense of preborn life and to advocate in favor of natural marriage. Huge crowds, nothing like it. We've never seen anything quite like it in the United States. And these are smaller countries. Huge crowds have shown up to do this, again, mainly of young people. I think something is happening. The elites don't have control anymore. I think the future, maybe for Christians, particularly for young Christians, there's going to be troubles ahead. I think there's going to be forms of persecution. You already see them happening. But it's also going to be a very exciting time to witness to the faith. It's not going to be a calm time, but it's going to be an exciting time. And in the end, I think the lessons of the natural family, which ultimately are also the lessons of Christian social and sexual ethics, are going to win out.
Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. He is author of 10 books, including The Natural Family, A Manifesto. He's written an editorial for the latest Touchstone magazine titled Majority Report, The Future of Marriage and the Natural Family. You'll find a link to the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society at our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Carlson, thank you so much for your time. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Folks, if you appreciate Dr. Carlson's insights, you're really going to want to listen to Pastor Jonathan Fisk's presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc., Making the Case Conference. He was making the case for the church's response to postmodernism. Now, we'll send you an audio DVD with more than 8 hours of teaching, preaching, and singing for a contribution of $300 to Issues, Etc. before Labor Day. You can order online. Just click the audio DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. You can also order by check. Make your $300 check payable to Issues, Etc. Send it to Issues, Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The address again, Issues, Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. It's an audio DVD of the 2015 Issues, Etc., Making the Case Conference. When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about how Jesus brings his grace, his forgiveness, his life, and his salvation to us. We have as our guest in the next half hour, Pastor Hal Sinkball says, we have a space and time problem. We can't go back to the cross, but Jesus brings the cross forward to us. We'll find out how after this.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
When the Apostle Paul stated, "I have become all things to all men," was he talking about fitting in with the world? I've written an article in the latest Issues, Etc. journal titled All Things to All Men. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues, Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read Pastor David Wan's story of failing to find Lutheran theology in several Lutheran churches, but finding it in Scripture and the Lutheran Confessions, the free online Issues, Etc. journal.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues, Etc. journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues, Etc. issuesetc.org.
Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
This is Pastor Tyler Arnold at Christ Lutheran in Platte Woods, Kansas City, Missouri. We are privileged to serve our Lord in word and sacrament through the historic liturgies of the church. Do join us for divine service at 8 and 10:45 and adult Bible study and Sunday school at 9:30. Each Wednesday evening we have Vespers at 7 p.m. Our address is 6700 Northwest 72nd Street, or call us at 816-741-0483. You can find us on the web at christlc.net. Come and be our guest at and with Christ.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.